You're listening to the 11th Hour, and we're talking about Shelley with poet Katie Donovan and lecturer Dr. Rebecca Peelan. One of the books we're discussing is Death and the Maidens, and that inspired us to think about Schubert's quartet in D minor, Death and the Maiden, and this is the Allegro from it. Listening to the 11th Hour, and we're talking about Shelley, and we're talking about a book by Janet Todd, and it's called Death and the Maiden, as that piece of music was called. Rebecca Peelan, you have the poem there.
Schubert set to music a poem by Katie Matthias.
It's Matthias Claudius, Claudius. I'm pronouncing it right.
The poem is in two parts. The first part is the maiden speaking, and she says, "Pass by, oh pass by, go away, fierce man of bone, I'm still young. Go, my dear, and do not touch me." And the second part of the poem, which Schubert incorporated into a different style of music, sinister and haunting, comes from Death. And Death says, "Give me your hand, you beautiful and delicate form. I am a friend and am not come to punish. Be of good cheer. I am not savage. You will sleep softly in my arms." And it's quite relevant that I would assume that that's why Janet Todd has selected the title, because of this notion of Shelley rescuing. That was the term, I think, that comes up time and time again in the two books, that he actually rescued these young women.
He felt he did.
Yeah. And in fact, I think at one point Fanny says, "I wanted him to come and rescue," or, you know, she writes a letter more or less asking him, Mary and Claire, to rescue her. Mm. And so Todd, of course, is setting it up not as a rescue, but as in fact almost certain death for these young women. Harriet, his first wife, by the way, also committed suicide. She drowned in the river.
This is 1816, a couple of months after Fanny committed suicide, yes, in Swansea. Yeah.
So it's quite relevant to this notion of the maiden and death, death calling the maiden and the maiden saying, "Please just pass me by and leave me alone," and death using this notion of rescue, come and lie softly in my arms. And
I'm assuming Shelley was... There's a lot of death surrounding Shelley.
He seemed to sort of almost see death as a peaceful option in the middle of all his turmoil. And Rowe writes a lot about how he would go off in these wildly impractical boats, not knowing how to swim, and let the current just take him away, as if he almost wanted. You know, he writes about in Lines of Dejection written near Naples about the whole idea of death being easeful and being under the water and being a release. So it's almost as though his is the voice of death that Todd is hinting at by using that title.
Of course, he died tragically himself.
Well, he did die in a shipwreck eventually, in a storm.
In a storm, yeah. Yes, visiting a friend of his, coming back across the Bay of Livorno.
That's right. I mean, Edward Williams and one boatman, and there was just this freak storm blew up. But apparently at the last minute, someone offered, another boat came close and said, "Can we help? Do something, you've got to save yourselves." And Shelley laughed them off. And what I found very interesting was, apart from all the women we've been talking about, late in life, towards the end of his life, I mean, it sounds like late, he was only 30, but he fell in love with another woman, Jane Williams, who's the wife of the man who was on the boat who drowned with Shelley. He went out in a boat with Jane Williams, just the two of them, and her two babies, a very, very insecure little craft, and he started rocking the boat and saying, death is wonderful, drowning is so wonderful, you know, we could just do it right now. You know, he almost actually killed them all. Mm. And so that makes, you know, that's a really troubling illustration of what Todd is suggesting.
Yeah, but Todd says in the book, like, that he rode into waterfalls and in small crafts, that this was the poet looking for the source.
I know, but I think when it comes to having a mother and two small babies in the same boat as yourself,
it's not a good literary device.
Well, the sinister quality of his relationship with death and his relationship with young women is very much illustrated, and that's why Todd has used that title for a book. That's what
it's probably saying. A moot point at this stage, but he couldn't swim.
Yeah, exactly.
His fascination with water. He refused, in fact, to learn to swim. Mm.
But Mary Shelley, of course, created Frankenstein while they were living in Geneva briefly in the 1816s after the Napoleonic War. And was it Shelley's obsession with death and water, or what? Where did that inspiration come from, do you think, Mary?
Well, he was very interested in Gothic. Gothic, of course, has had a very long history in terms of English literature. And he was very interested in Gothic stories and tales of death and not so much afterlife, because he, being an atheist, he actually believed that that was just a, what he was interested in, by the way, was the relationship between going to sleep and dying and where your unconscious went. I mean, remember, this is pre-psychoanalysis or pre any kind of notion of what actually happens when you go to sleep. But Frankenstein came about as a result of a kind of competition that they have, which is interesting. That was the first time in one of these books that it was named as the evening of the 16th of June, which, of course, is significant for us, being Bloomsday and all sorts of other things. But the 16th of June, where Shelley, Mary Shelley, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Byron, and someone else,
Polidori, a doctor,
were together, and they decided to have a kind of competition as to who could write the best frightening story. That's what it, where it came from. Frankenstein, though, is much more than just that. I mean, I think it's Roe, as well as Todd, but Todd in particular, really focus on the notion of just so much about what Shelley's had been interested in terms of death and dying, and is actually woven into Frankenstein. It's very clearly, you know.
Well, one would argue that Mary Shelley's genius was equally to Percy's genius, but after his death, she still served as myth, didn't she, Katie?
Well, she did. I think life with Shelley for her must have been extremely hard, because she lost three children. Only one of their children survived. They were constantly on the move. It was very difficult to maintain any kind of domestic security. But she also had an intellectual life of her own. She was highly intelligent. She was always reading, keeping up with everything. And she had to put up with this man who only slept if someone forced him to go to bed, or if he fell asleep. He was always going off. So how could she maintain a loving relationship with this kind of erratic person who was unfaithful to her? She knew
Her half-sister was living in the same house.
Well, exactly. And she wanted to maintain a loving and equal relationship with him, and also have her own life as a writer and an intellectual. And I think Frankenstein blows anything that Shelley ever wrote out of the water. I'm sorry, I think it's a fantastic book. It has the status of myth. It goes into a place that Shelley possibly never went. It was also inspired by a story that was being told that night about a corpse's head that is somehow reanimated. Mm. And it was based on a nightmare that she had had about how someone lying in bed is faced with this monstrous creature, a creature that he himself has created. And then the book goes into this very interesting, the relationship between the creator and the created, and the creator is almost like a father rejecting his child. And, you know, you begin to think about Mary.
Yeah, was she talking about...
Yes, her
Percy.
Own life. Yeah, or her father, William Godwin. Mm. You know, so the book is endlessly fascinating, I have to say, about Frankenstein. But what's interesting is that Mary Shelley blamed herself terribly after Shelley died for having closed off from him, because she suffered so much with this kind of crazy domestic scene she was forced to endure while still loving him. But she shut off expressing that love. I think she was so hurt and so down. And then afterwards, when he died, I think she was so full of regret that she hadn't enjoyed the years while she could have, that she just wiped the slate clean and just presented him as an angel, that he was an angel from heaven and she wasn't having any other account of him. And she was the one.
A bit like an Irish mother, like, you know.
It was largely Mary Shelley, though, who contributed to the construction of Shelley as a genius, for the Victorians in particular, who really picked up on that. It largely came from her description of his genius and his abilities. And in fact, she hid an awful lot of details about his life. and just spoke of him in absolutely glowing terms.
And remained faithful to his idea of being the great poet.
Yes.
Even though despite all the pain and tragedy. Does any of that pain and tragedy manifest in his poems, or are they all just sort of like deeply esoteric, intellectual?
No, I actually picked a couple of examples if we've got time to do them.
I'd love to hear one, yeah.
I mean, one of them is really to do with monogamy. This is just an excerpt from it. I'm sure I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but it's Epipsychidion, I think. Epipsychidion. I never was attached to that great sect whose doctrine is that each one should select out of the crowd a mistress or a friend, and all the rest, though fair and wise, commend to cold oblivion, though it is in the code of modern morals. I mean, that's very clearly anti-monogamy and his stance on the whole notion of selecting one person and letting all of these other fair people go. And then another very short one called A Dirge, which is about grief, which I actually think is quite beautiful. And it was written after Fanny's death. Rough wind that moanest loud, grief too sad for song. Wild wind when sullen cloud knells all the night long. Sad storm whose tears are in vain. Bare woods whose branches strain, deep caves and dreary main, wail for the world's wrong. So, no, I mean, he was a romantic. I don't think there's any question about the fact
that's
that
quite
he was
simple
a romantic.
Compared
Very
to
simple.
Compared to his big long lyrical yes. poems, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the longer poems that contain a lot of classical references, like, you know.
A lot.
Yeah, I think it just makes for the reader makes it kind of hard today, especially as a lot of us don't have a classical background.
And was so that the intellectual debate at the time? Did everybody have a classical background and knew all the Greek and Roman classical gods and figures and stories and intellectual debate?
Well, Shelley was obsessed with the Greeks,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Was, yeah. Absolutely obsessed. But Plato. The literati would have. And in many ways that would have marked off, a great poet from somebody who was simply writing this short political or personal stuff. Mont Blanc, for instance, which is one of his famous poems as well, deals with nature in the most extraordinarily complex way. And again, Anne Rowe, in her book Being Shelley, I think picks up on that incredible relationship that he had with the elements and with nature, which is also common to the Romantics. You know, the whole notion of the Romantics coming across the Alps, for example, and being they're just having their breath taken away by the sheer magnitude. And this is an atheist, remember. This is where the spirituality comes in, the fact that it's not God necessarily, but that it's so awe-inspiring. And of course, awe is something to do with, we associate it with to do with God. But yes, you're right. Despite the fact that they're atheists, it is still awe-inspiring that Mont Blanc, for instance, will take your breath away.
And I think nowadays, you know, another reason why we may not relate to Shelley so much is it is so much about the natural world, the way he writes. And we've become so disjointed from that. You know, it's just not groovy anymore to write poetry about a sylvan scene or even in, you know, rural Ireland. We've become mostly an urban society. Mm. And poetry now is kind of reflecting that. It's become more urban. It's become more kind of cynical. You know, there isn't this sort of striving, questing, exciting feel about it.
Did Shelley not see the truth and simplicity being in the same sentence, really, in his poetry? It was all like the source, the truth of the poet.
He was very interested in the source, but he wouldn't have necessarily, as I understand it, distinguished between the source of us as humans, going back to earth, for instance, dust, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Just he went back to, he was burned. In fact, he was on a funeral.
A very famous painting was made of it.
Exactly, he wouldn't have made a distinction between that and finding the source of a river, for example. Do you know what that was? Just simply part of that nature. He just saw it as an extension, and there was an idealistic belief which did come from Godwin and his egalitarian belief that if you looked after yourself and you sought the source of yourself, I mean, I don't want to be flippant about this, but Monty Python, The Meaning of Life, it really is the core. You know, what is it about? Why am I here? What is at the core of my being?
And Shelley was the first English poet to take that on in a very serious way. Thank you to poet Katie Donovan and Dr. Rebecca Palin from the UCD School of English and Drama for sharing your thoughts on two new books about Percy Bysshe Shelley. Dittin' the Maidens, Fanny Wollstonecraft and the Shelley Circle by Janet Todd, published by Profile Books, and Being Shelley, The Poet's Search for Himself by Anne Rowe, published by Jonathan Cape.